announcement to start the class.
So use this mic.
Hi, everyone. I'm Antonella Telez.
I'm Ashwin Chandra.
And we're running for ESCOV co-presidents. There's a runoff election today from noon to 11:59 p.m., and we would really appreciate if you all voted for us. because the election last week was really close, so every vote counts. Thank you.
So you ready for your two questions? I think the first question I've kind of got out of the way already. Who's not in a group yet? Okay, everybody's in a group, right? So I'll stop asking that question. Who's not picked a company yet? Keep trying, right? Get it out of the way, okay? So for those of you who picked a company, the project is well underway, right? You've got, even though you might not know it, because at this stage, you have to be assessing where the power lies in your company. Keep your focus, right? We said there's an end game here. The end game you're asking here is, where does the power lie in this company? It could lie with the managers. It could lie with U.S. stockholders. Maybe it lies with inside stockholders as opposed to outside stockholders. But that's the first part of this project, is getting a sense of where the power lies. What's driving this company? So the next step in this process, of course, is to start to put some flesh and bones on risk and return. And last session, I gave you my definition of risk. I said risk is a combination of danger and opportunity. And I said every risk and return model in finance is about measuring the danger in an investment and asking, how much opportunity do I need to compensate me for taking that danger? So let's look at what a good risk and return model would allow us to do. Then we can look at all the choices we have and measure them up against, are they measuring up to what we define as good? A good risk and return model should come up with a measure of risk that is universal. You know what I mean by universal? It can't be just a risk and return model that works for stocks but not for private companies. It can't be a risk and return model that works only for financial assets and not for real estate. I'd like a risk and return model that's universal, because as investors, we can invest in lots of different places, and we want something that will allow us to make those choices. Second, a good risk and return model should be very specific about what kinds of risks you will get rewarded for and what kinds of risks you would not get rewarded for. Like you're saying, what kinds of risk would I not be rewarded for? I'll give you an absurd example. Let's suppose you live across the highway from a brokerage house, which is where you trade every day. And every morning you wake up and you run across a six-lane highway to get to your brokerage house. You could die every day. You think, I'm bearing a lot of risk. I should earn a high return. You're not going to get rewarded for that kind of risk. And you're going to see very quickly that a great deal of risk that you think you're exposed to an investment, you might not get rewarded for because you have a choice of not taking that risk. So a good risk and return model should say, these are the risks you will get rewarded for, and these are the risks you will not. Third, it should take that risk and give you a risk measure which is standardized. What I mean by standardized is, if I say the risk measure for your company is X, you should be able to look at X and say, that's a high number. That's an average number, that's a low number, without my giving you 50 other, you know, companies so you can have a comparison. Fourth step, it should take that risk measure, and remember the end game here is we need to come up with hurdle rates, percentage returns. A good risk and return model will try to take that risk measure and convert it into a return that we can then use as a hurdle rate. And here's a final requirement, and this is the tough one. A good risk and return model should actually work. You know what I mean by work? Over time, if you tell me that this is my measure of risk, and I look at what stocks earn as returns, the two should be correlated. So I should be able to, maybe not every year, but if I take the last 50 years, I take your risk measure and I take returns, and your model works, the two should go together. That's what a good risk and return model will include. So let's start with the risk and return model that everybody who takes a finance class is fed. You've seen it in foundations, which is the capital asset pricing model. The most misunderstood and maligned model in the history of economics. Misunderstood because people read into it whatever they want to. Maligned because it becomes the symbol of everything you hate about finance and portfolio theory. I don't like to do this because I don't like betas. I'm going to give you a completely non-statistical derivation of the CAPM. And along the way, I'm going to be try to be as open as I can about the limitations along the way. So the CAPM came into being in the early 60s, 1963, 64. And Sharpe and Lindner, the two people who developed, ended up winning Nobel Prizes 25 years later. So here's what the CAPM does. And at each step, you're going to have to map it against a good risk and return model. In the CAPM, we measure risk using variance, variance of actual returns around an expected return. Okay. And we said, that's how we measure risk. You're saying, what's the big deal? That sounds like a good measure. I'm going to point out to you the limitations of that measure in a minute. But we start with it. It's called the mean variance framework. The good stuff we measure with the expected return. The bad stuff we measure with variance. Second step, it specifies that only the portion of that variance that cannot be diversified away will be rewarded. Why? Because you can diversify. You choose not to. That's your problem, not mine, or the markets. The market is not going to reward if you take all your money and put it in NVIDIA and say, I love NVIDIA, that's all I'm going to invest in. That's a choice you make. So in the CAPM, we assume that only the portion of the variance that cannot be diversified away is rewarded. And I'll give you the rationale that the CAPM uses to arrive there. Third, it measures that non-diversifiable risk with a beta. And again, beta has all this mythology associated with it. But one thing about betas is they're standardized. Around what number? One. An average beta is one. So when I tell you the beta for a stock is 1.5, if you buy into the CAPM, and that's a big if, I'm telling you this stock is riskier than the average stock in the market. And then it takes that beta and comes up with an expected return. So if you can tell me what the beta of a stock is, I can tell you what the expected return should be with two other numbers that I need to estimate. The first is a risk-free rate. That should be easy, right? Well, not necessarily, as we'll see. And the second is a risk premium, what you think you will earn on risky assets. Is that RM minus RF that you see in brackets and equations? It's that premium over and above the risk-free rate that you think you can earn by investing in them. And I'm going to kill it with mild praise. The model works at least as well as the next best model. Notice what I did not say. It works well. It works at least as... You know what Winston Churchill once said about democracy? He said, it's a terrible system until you compare it to the alternatives. The CAPM works at least as well as the next best model. So we're going to take each step in the CAPM and think through what we're assuming and why it might get us into trouble. Let's start with the first one. In the CAPM, the risk in investment is defined in terms of variance. When I say variance, you think statistical, you think backward-looking. So let me give you how the CAPM thinks about variance. It's variance in actual returns around an expected return. I'm going to give you four investments to illustrate how this will play out. Let's assume you invest in a one-year T-bill and you have a one-year time horizon. And let's for the moment assume the U.S. Treasury has no default risk. And right now, the one-year T-bill rate is about 1.5%. So you go out and you buy a one-year T-bill. And 1 year from now, I come and knock on your door and say, what did you make on the T-bill? What's your answer going to be? There's no default risk. It's a one-year T-bill. You have a one-year time horizon. You're going to make exactly 1.5%. This is a risk-free investment. Your actual return is always equal to expected return. Why? Because the U.S. Treasury has no default risk. Your time horizon matches up to that one-year T-bill. You got exactly what you expected. That's a riskless investment. Let's say you decide to buy a 10-year T-bond, and you still have only a one-year time horizon. The U.S. Treasury still has no default risk. But at the end of 1 year, I come and knock on your door. Is your return guaranteed? What portion of your return is guaranteed? The coupon is going to come in. What portion is not? The price of the bond could change. Why? Because interest rates change, the price of the bond changes. A 10-year T-bond is not risk-free if you're looking at a one-year time horizon. There's variance. Already I'm laying the foundations for risk-free rates. There's no such thing as one risk-free rate. Until you tell me your time horizon, I can't even tell you what the risk-free rate should be. So a 10-year T-bond is riskier than a one-year T-bill if you have a one-year time horizon. Let's say you look at a 10-year corporate bond. Now, in addition to interest rate changing, what else could change? The risk of the company could change, and if the risk of the company changes, it adds to the risk. So a 10-year corporate bond is riskier than a 10-year T-bond. Let's move one further step up the ladder. Let's say you invest in Con Ed. Very safe stock, but still a stock. You do it because you like the dividends, and you might get the dividends as expected, but remember, dividends are not guaranteed. There's no contractual requirement, but with Con Ed, you're probably going to get the dividends with a high probability. But at the end of the year, I've asked you, how much did you make on Con Ed? You might have made your dividend, but the stock price could have gone all over because the market could go up, it could go down, Con Ed could go up or down. Much riskier than the corporate bond. So we've gone from T-bill to T-bond to corporate bond to Con Ed. It's clear. I told you I was going to give you four examples. Let's add a fifth one. Everybody's jumping on the Tesla bandwagon, right? It's at 840. You say, I got left behind. Now is the time for me to jump in. One of the interesting things is all these sell-side equity research analysts are magically coming up with target prices now asking you to buy, which should be a deadly sign if you're thinking about buying, but that's a different story. So at $840, you say, you know what? I'm going to buy Tesla. So let's say you do. At the end of the next year, I come and knock on your door. If you're lucky, what could have happened? It could go to 1,500. This is a stock that zooms all over the place. If you're not, it could be down to 200. Much riskier than Con Ed. So we've gone from T-bill to T-bond to corporate bond to Con Ed to Tesla. In every one of these cases, though, when we talked about variance, it's always in the future. It's about uncertainty by the future. See why I'm emphasizing that? Because if I ask you, what's a variance in Tesla? After finance class, what are you trained to do? You run to the Bloomberg. You look at the past because that's where the data is. And this is a conundrum we've got to deal with in finance. All our data is in the past, but all our uncertainty is in the future. You say, what choice do I have? You're right, you might not have no choice, but remember, it requires a leap of faith to take the past and say, that's what the future is going to look like. So if you ask me, how risky is Disney? My crutch will be to go look at the past, they've been traded, give you the variance. So basically, I've computed the returns and standard deviations in Disney going back between 2008 and 13. So in 2014, you asked me, how risky is Disney? I could give you this number, but if I'm careful, I should add a caveat, which is the company's changing. This might have been the variance for the last 5 years, but they're now much bigger into, you know, into Pixar and the Marvel movies. I think the variance in the future might be higher or lower. But this is something we're going to have to deal with over and over again. Our measures of risk come from looking at the past. But our worries about risk are all in the future. So in traditional CAPM, we start with the presumption that variance measures risk. And often that variance is estimated by looking backwards. But I want to go back to the core of the entire model, which is expected return is good, variance is bad, nothing else matters. And I'm going to pose a challenge for you, a question for you. And the way you answer this question is going to tell us how solid this presumption is, that all we care about as investors is expected return and variance. I'm going to come to you with two investments. The two investments have the same expected return and the same standard deviation. So in the CAPM world, what should be true? You should be indifferent between the two, right? I'm going to throw a couple of glitches into this process, and you tell me as investors whether this might tilt your choice. So same expected return, same standard deviation. But company A offers this very small chance you could quadruple your money, while company B, the best possible payoff you can get is plus 50%. It's already in the expected return, the standard deviation, but I'm just throwing out, there is this very small chance you could quadruple your money on company A, but the best you can do on company B is 50%. Might that affect your investment choice? Because if you lived in a CAPM world, what should you say? I don't care. So here's what I'm asking you, and don't think about what should the CAPM ask me to do. I want you to think as an investor what you would do. How many of you would be indifferent between these two investments still? So one, two. Two of us live in the CAPM world. The rest of us are either still waking up or we don't live in the CAPM world. Already you can see why the foundations of mean variance are built on fairly loose foundations, because most of us don't live it. In fact, how many would prefer investment day because of the chance of quadrupling your money? No, I would too. It's human nature, right? It's a very small chance, but this is called, if you want to give it a fancy name, preference for skewness. Investors like skewness. They like the chance, positive skewness. They like the chance that you could have this chance of quadrupling your money. I mean, you probably heard that Berkshire Hathaway invested in Kroger last week. Now, notice I didn't say Warren Buffett invested in Kroger, even though that's what the news story said. Warren Buffett is 90 years old. He's not picking stocks. He's basically, you know, doing his usual shtick. It's, you know, Berkshire Hathaway is now run by guys he handpicked to pick stocks. They pick Kroger. If I told you Kroger and Tesla have the same expected return standard deviation, let's say that's true, I would still pick Tesla over Kroger. Why? Because there is no chance Kroger is going to quadruple in the next 5 years. There's no upside scenario that you see, but Tesla could, which means there might be people who invest in Tesla even though the expected returns are lower than on other investments because they value that probability of quadrupling their money. Keep that in mind when you look at people investing in small companies, high growth companies. That tail in the distribution is what's drawing you, which means you like that upside. Let me go revert back to my original example. Expected return is 15%. Standard deviation is 25%. Now, forget about the big payoffs upside. Let's think about the downside. Let's assume that on company, there's a chance that you could lose all your money. But on company B, the worst that can happen to you is you can lose only 50%. Might that affect your decision as well? This is called loss aversion. There are some investors who worry about downside risk, and that becomes a focus, which means if I gave you two investments, they have the same expected return standard deviation, you'll pick the one where the worst case scenario is less bad because you worry about worst case scenarios. You think, which one is right? There's no right or wrong. We're all born with utility functions, things that we value. Some of us want the upside, and we're going to go after the stocks that quadruple their money. Some of us are very risk-averse. We worry about the downside. But the bottom line is, neither of us is going to live in the mean variance world because we're thinking about upside or downside. So the starting foundation for every risk and return model in finance is the mean variance framework. And already we're casting some doubt about what that will do to our end results. Let's come back to it when we ask, does the model work? Maybe this might explain where the model doesn't work that well. Second step in the process, and this to me is where finance changed the way we think about risk. Until the early 50s, the way economists thought about risk is they stopped at step one. They said, stocks with a lot of variance should be riskier than stocks with less variance, and we should therefore get a higher return if we invest in stocks that move a lot. And along came Harry Markowitz in the early 50s, and he said, and he's actually a PhD student at Princeton, sitting at the library working through this, when he noticed that there were these high variance stocks that if you added them to a portfolio, were not that risky. So we're going to go to the foundations of why diversification reduces risk. And again, I'm not going to use statistics to prove it. I'm going to use Disney as my example. If you take Disney and you think about investing in Disney, think about all the risks you're exposed to. The first risk is that they have some big budget movies. The next Pixar movie is coming out, Upward, Onward, whatever it is, coming out in a few months. It could be a super hit, could be an average hit, it could be a fiasco. There is risk on every project that Disney takes. But that's risk that affects only Disney. If the next Avengers movie crashes and burns, Disney will be hurt, but the rest of the world is not going to come to a standstill. Oh my God, no, the Avengers are dead. I should take that back. But this is risk that affects just Disney. You're going to see where this is going, so kind of hang in there with me. So the individual movies. Disney's big investment in the last few months has been Disney Plus. And the fate of Disney Plus is going to be driven not just by what Disney does, but what Apple does and what NBC does and what Netflix definitely does. And to the extent that they do something unexpected, Disney could do better than expected or worse than expected on Disney Plus, which means that when you're looking at that investment, you're looking at an investment where five or six companies are affected by the downturn. So we've gone from risk that affects just Disney to risk that affects five or six companies. Disney owns ESPN and ABC. It's part of the broadcasting business. If next year a law was passed by Congress tightening rules on the broadcasting business, I don't know whether network neutrality would be it, but something happens, it's going to affect Disney and every other company in the broadcasting business. And there are about 150 companies, because it's not just the broadcasting companies, it's all the companies that feed into those broadcasting companies. So you've gone from risk that affects one company to five or six companies to 150 companies. The biggest Disney theme park in recent years in terms of cost was Shanghai Disney. And Shanghai Disney right now has very few people coming in because of the coronavirus. That risk is risk that Disney is exposed to because it chose to invest in another country. It's now exposed to exchange rate risk, political risk. But it's not just Disney. Hundreds of companies. You probably saw the news story. Apple announced that their iPhone shipments would be down because their factories are shut down, and demand is down. So this could potentially be 500,000, maybe 1,500 companies that are affected. We've gone from one risk, one company, to six companies, to maybe 150 companies, to maybe 1,000 companies. Last week, Jerome Powell was giving us, talk to Congress. Jerome Powell is the Fed chair. And everything came to a standstill on Wall Street, as it always does. Why? Because people are watching for signals, smoke signals, if he's smoking, but I guess he can't smoke. But basically, every word, people are waiting. What is he saying? Is there a deeper meaning there? What are they looking for? They're looking for signals as to whether interest rates will go up. So during his testimony, he said, we're seeing signs inflation is picking up. You know what's going to happen almost instantaneously after those words come out of his mouth? Markets are going to collapse across the board because the implicit signal there is inflation is kicking up, interest rates are going to go up. If interest rates go up, is Disney affected? Absolutely. But is Disney the only? Every company, every investment you have is affected by changing interest rates. You're saying, so what? If you put all your money in Disney, which of these risks are you exposed to? All of them. The benefit of diversification is when you invest in Disney and 50 other companies, let's see how these risks play out. I talked about the next project for Disney, the next movie doing better than expected. But if you have 50 companies, each of which is taking projects, where on individual projects things can be better or worse than expected, think of what's going to happen in your portfolio. Risk that is specific to a company can cut in both directions. It's a law of large numbers in statistics. That's basically what it is. Is when you have 50 companies in your portfolio, risks that are affecting one or a few companies are going to start to average out in your portfolio. In fact, every day when I just read the headlines in the journal. I go through different degrees of ups and downs as I go through the news stories. Because I see a news story about my company, I say, this is good news. My stock went up 15%. I should stop there. Because two news stories later, there's another company I'm investing in. I say, this is terrible. My stock dropped 15%. But if you look at individual problems, they tend to average out, maybe not on the same day, but across time. The strongest argument for diversification is that argument, which is when you hold lots of companies in your portfolio, firm-specific risks are going to average out across time. But risks that affect most or all companies will not average out. So interest rate risk will not be. You could be in every stock in the S&P. You can be in every U.S. stock, every global stock. But if interest rates go up significantly today, I don't care how diversified you are, you're going to feel the pain tomorrow when you open up and check what happened to your portfolio. So risks that affect most or all companies will play out in your portfolio. And therein comes this gray area. Interest rate risk is clearly macro risk. We're still trying to negotiate a way as to whether the coronavirus is a macro risk or something we should diversify away. And the way it's affecting markets suggests that it's getting closer to the macro risk column than the micro, because so many companies are affected by what happens in China. If this had been a much smaller market and a much smaller, it might have been contained, but there is no way you can stop this because pretty much every company has some China effect play out. So that is the reason for diversifying, is by diversifying, you're averaging out risk. Now comes the part in the CAPM where you see why the model can assume that, because investors can diversify, they can choose not to. In fact, we know that most investors don't diversify. If you get a chance, read the weekly challenge from this week, or the weekly puzzle from this week. And one of the links I have is to a paper that looked at typically how many stocks do individual investors who invest actively hold. The good news is most investors don't invest actively. Why is that good news? Because when investors invest actively, the more active you are, the lower your returns tend to be. Okay? Most investors invest through mutual funds, but there are investors who think they can beat the market. They go out and buy stocks. You know the median number of stocks in an individual investor's portfolio is 3 to 5. So if I stopped right there, you'd say investors are not diversified. And the CAPM assumes that only that investors are diversified. So here's where I'm going to introduce what I'll call the marginal investor. And this marginal investor is going to play a huge role in how we think about risk. You think, who the heck is a marginal investor? The marginal investor is the one who, at the margin, sets prices for a stock. So let's start off with a reality check. None of us is ever going to be a marginal investor. Why? I could own 10,000 shares of Apple, 100,000, even Carl Icahn found he couldn't move the stock price because it's such a widely held and liquid stock with a $1 trillion market cap. That to affect the price, you have to own a lot of shares, and you have to trade those shares. In the CAPM, the assumption is not that every investor is diversified, but that the marginal investor is diversified. Now, we can ask, is that a sensible assumption? I'm going to do this with my companies, and I'm going to give you a tool to do that with the company you've picked. Notice the nag, you've got to pick a company to do this. Okay? Because this is a key step in the process. Because the marginal investor is diversified, you have to look at risk through that marginal investor's eyes because you have no choice. You basically are riding the marginal investor's perception of risk, even though you're an individual investor who's not diversified. So there are two things that you need for the margin, for a marginal investor. You need to own a lot of shares, and you need to trade those shares. Both, and that is why the largest investor in a company might not be the marginal investor. Mark Zuckerberg is not the marginal investor in Facebook. You know why? He owns a lot of shares, but what does he not do? He can't trade them for two reasons. One is giving up control. The second is every time an insider trades, you got to let the SEC know this is not something we call a broker. So sell 10 million right now. Larry Ellison is not the marginal investor in Oracle, even though he's the largest individual investor. The marginal investor has to be somebody who owns a lot of shares and trades those shares. You know, how the hell am I going to find out who that is? Let me give you a very simple starting point. For your companies, you can find out what percentage of your stock is held by institutions and insiders. Here I'm going to ask you a question I should have asked at the start. How many of you have followed the Capital IQ instructions that I sent you? You have no idea what you're saying. What Capital IQ? What is he talking about? I've sent you these instructions 3 times. I'll send them to you a 4th time today. When you get a chance, register, because Capital IQ is just this immense data set of every publicly traded company in the world. It's got data on 68,000 publicly traded companies, and it's got every piece of public information on these companies. All the financial data, all the accounting data, all the market data, and they also have data like what percentage of the stock in your company is held by insiders and what percentage is held by institutions. I'll give you a low-tech way of getting the same data. If you go to Yahoo Finance and you look at your company, you will find the institutional insider holding. You're saying, what is that going to tell me? If the percentage of stock held in your company by institutions is high, what's high? I think if you look at the S&P 500, 75% of the stock in most of the S&P 500 companies is held by institutions. You know what I mean by institutions, right? It's mutual funds, pension funds, endowment funds, big institutional investors. If the percent of stock held by institutions is high and by insiders is low, you can pretty safely assume that your marginal investor is some kind of institutional investor. You don't have to put a name on the investor. It could be Fidelity today, it could be BlackRock tomorrow, but you're done. Your marginal investor is institutional. And is it safe to assume that that institutional investor is diversified? I think it's pretty safe to assume that unless Fidelity has lost its mind, it's not taking all the money that it's collecting and buying Tesla. Let me take that back. Maybe some institutions might have lost their mind. But it's essentially, with an institution, you can assume that they're holding. You don't have to assume supreme diversification, that they have 50, 30, 80 stocks in their portfolio. If the percent of stocks held by institutions is high and by insiders is high, then you have a trick here. Okay. Facebook, for instance, has a pretty high percentage held by institutions, but also a pretty high percentage held by insiders because you got Mark Zuckerberg, the insiders, holding those shares. But in those cases, you'd still go with the institutional investor because the insiders here can't trade, as we talked about Zuckerberg and Larry Ellison not trading, with some constraints, which is that institution, the fact that insiders hold it could still affect price of the margin, but it's still an institutional investor. If the percentage of shares held by institutions is low and the percentage is held by founders is high, it's tough to tell. You have to look at where the trading comes from. In fact, you have databases that tell you what percentage of the trading in a stock is done by institutions. I'll give you an example. I'm going to look at Tata Motors. Tata Motors, about 40% of the stock is held by the Tata family through Tata companies. About 25% is held by institutions. You're saying that's a pretty low number. But 85% of the trading in Tata Motors is done by institutions. So when I look at that number, even though institutions might hold only 25%, the fact that they account for the bulk of the trading is my tiebreaker. If they accounted for only 25% of the trading, I have a trick here, challenge. If the percent of stock held by institutions is low and the percent of stock held by insiders is high, but it's now some wealthy individual investor, not a founder, then things get really messy. You see why? Because if that individual owns only this stock, you might have some, it's like a private company. He's going to push the company to do things that make him or her comfortable, and that might not be what an institutional investor who's diversified would be pushing for. And finally, if you have low on both, it could very well be a small individual investor who owns only 3 to 5 stocks. You think, who cares? What is the cap, I'm assuming? The margin investor is diversified, and all you care about is the risk you cannot diversify away. That's going to be safe if you're in the first three scenarios where the institutional investor is your margin investor. But if the margin investor becomes an individual who's not diversified, or a wealthy individual is throwing his or her weight around, you might not be able to use the CAPM or, in fact, any risk and return model in finance because they're all built on the presumption of diversification. So what do we do then? There's a reason I picked Bookscape as one of my 6 companies to do. If you remember, Bookscape is a privately owned bookstore in New York City. Who's the marginal investor in a privately owned business? It's usually the owner. Are owners of privately owned businesses usually diversified people? They can't afford to be. Their entire wealth is tied up in the business. It's the exact opposite of diversified. So this is not going to be academic there. So I'm going to give you a way of adjusting these models for the fact that investors are not diversified. But let's get the easier case out of the way first before we build on what happens if investors are not diversified. So your first stop with your company is going to be to stop and ask, is the marginal investor in my company diversified? And I'm going to go back to a page I looked at when I looked at where does the power lie in my company. Remember the top 17 investors? There I was looking at it to ask the question, where does the power lie? Who runs a company? Will there be somebody here asking tough questions? Now I'm going to look at the same list with a different question. Who's the marginal investor in this company? Is it an institution, an individual, an insider? And with Disney in 2013, remember I showed you 2003, there were no individuals, or at least Roy Disney, but he was a very small owner. 2009, the biggest investor was Steve Jobs. 2013, it was Lorraine Jobs, basically, you know, because she inherited the shares. But you also see one more individual pop up, George Lucas. And how did he get there? The same way that Steve Jobs did, which is when Disney bought Lucasfilms, George Lucas got a share of the company, so about 1.7%. But if I look at that list, I know Laureen Jobs is not the marginal investor. You know how I know that? If you look at the percentage of shares in Disney she owns, and you compare it to what she owned or what the Jobs family owned in 2009, there's almost no change. She owns a lot of shares, but she's not trading those shares. Could George Lucas be my marginal investor? Maybe if he sent Luke Skywalker to trade for him. But I don't think the SEC is going to accept that excuse of Luke traded the shares, it wasn't under my control. I think I'm on pretty safe ground here, assuming the marginal investor in Disney is some institutional investor. Whether it's BlackRock or Vanguard, I really don't care. So don't try to put a name on the individual investor because they're interchangeable, at least for this question. Because here you're asking, is that investor likely to be diversified? And I would say the answer is yes for pretty much everybody in that list who's an institutional investor. Get used to seeing BlackRock on that list. In fact, when you print this list off for your company, I'll wager that 85 to 90% of the companies in this class, BlackRock is there. It's like, where's Waldo? You go to the most obscure markets in the world, the Ivory Coast, you take the top 10 companies, BlackRock, BlackRock, BlackRock. If you had a conspiratorial view of the world, BlackRock is your demon because they're pretty much owners of everything, but they're diversified. So the question you're trying to answer here is the marginal investor diversified? With Disney, I feel pretty safe assuming the marginal investor is diversified. So I did the same thing for my other companies, and you can see that the breakdown of institutional investors is very high at Disney and Vale. In Vale, remember, there are two classes of shares. The voting shares are never traded. Why? Because they're for control. The seven entities own it. So basically, the preferred shares are traded, and in the preferred shares, it's 71% is held by institutions. It's lower for Deutsche, but that 41% that's held by institutions accounts for 90% of the trading volume on Deutsche. And for Tata Motors and Baidu, so basically with every one of my five companies, I feel pretty comfortable assuming the marginal investor is diversified. But I definitely can't make that assumption for my privately held company. Now, I hope that for your company you get to the same conclusion because it's much your life gets easier if your marginal investor is diversified. But for some of your companies, especially if you've picked a small company which has a very low profile, you might end up with a company where the marginal investor is not diversified. And what I do at Bookscape might be the way you have to estimate cost of equity. But this is your first stop before you start estimating betas and estimating a cost of equity on that, because you want to make sure your marginal investor is diversified before you make those judgments. So that's the second stop. Any questions on the second stop? So variance measures risk. And only that portion of the variance that you cannot diversify is going to get rewarded. Why? Because the people who price your stock are diversified investors. And whether you like it or not, you've got to play the game the way they play it. And they're going to put in only the risk that you cannot diversify away. Yes?
Can you explain the difference between whether the marginal investor is diversified or not and what that means to us?
If your marginal investor is not diversified, you're closer to a private business than a public company. That's really the difference. You got to do the things I will do for a private company than for your company. So that's really and it's a big difference because it'll mean your hurdle rates are going to be much higher for your company because you're now incorporating all the risk in the company rather than just a portion of the risk that cannot be diversified away. It makes a big difference on your hurdle rates. Right? Now comes the third step. So if you accept the proposition that diversification is good, and it's a pretty common sense one, right? There are proverbs going back in time. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. It's a diversification proverb, right? People have always said you should spread your bets. The question then becomes, how much should I carry this through? Okay. Now, let me get personal. I am a diversified investor. I'm also an investor in investment value. And this is actually a false choice you're often given. Do you want to invest to beat the market or do you want to be diversified? Why can't you be both? Right? I am a diversified investor, but I have only 53 stocks in my portfolio. Accumulated over a long time, but only, you're saying, what do you mean only 53 stocks? There are 43,000 publicly traded companies, and that's just stocks. I don't own the bonds, the real estate. I stopped at 53. So I'm going to ask you a question. Why did I stop at 53? Give me the cruel answer first. Because I don't have enough money. Okay, we got that out of the way. I'm not worth $100 billion. I can't be... But what's the second reason I stopped? I kind of gave that away. Well, forget about smart. No, you can be stupid and try to pick stocks. You can be smart, but it's hard to, you can't beat the market by holding 43,000 stocks because by definition, you're going to match the market. I hold on to this delusion maybe that I can do better than the market, so I'm going to try to beat the market. So I am picking, I think, the best stocks, whether that's true or not, and I have this limit on how much money I can invest. You know what the CAPM assumes? It assumes no transactions costs and no private information, which is a euphemism for you can't pick stocks. So if I take away those two constraints, in fact, you're saying, even take a look at Fidelity Magellan, right? It's a fund that has tens of billions of dollars, but it stops at 150 stocks. Can't be that they don't have enough money. There's a point at which you stop because there's a trade-off, which is adding an extra stock gives you a diversification benefit. That benefit gets smaller and smaller as you keep adding stocks. The second stock you add to your portfolio will give you a bigger benefit than the third and the fourth and the fifth. It's always positive, but it's getting smaller. There is a transactions cost. So when I say transactions cost, what comes to mind for you? How many of you e-trade or, I mean, right now, you know, I have Schwab. I think they'll pay me money to trade sooner rather than later because at this point, I'm paying almost nothing on a trade. But that is not even close to what my total transactions costs are. There are two other numbers that go into transactions costs. What's the first one? Let's say you buy a stock, and an instant later, you change your mind and sell it off. Even if the market price has not changed, you're going to leave some money on the table because there's a bid-ask spread. You're saying, how big can that be? For a stock like Apple, it's close to nothing. But if I take a lightly traded stock on the NASDAQ and try this, I could leave 15 to 20% of the price on the table because the spread is huge. That's it. The other cost is a price impact. Something I don't have to worry about, but if Fidelity owns 10% of a company and decides to sell it all, the moment it puts that sell order, the price is going to drop. There's a transactions cost. So there's a reason people stop diversifying. But the first assumption the CAPM makes is no transactions costs. And you can't pick stock. If there are no transactions costs and there's no private information, when should I have stopped diversifying? I shouldn't have stopped at 53, not at 5,000, not at 15,000. I shouldn't have stopped until I had in my portfolio every single traded asset in the market held in proportion to its market value. I know it sounds absurd, but think of this as a gigantic index fund which holds a piece of everything. We're actually pretty close to that. If you go to Vanguard, there are these total market funds. Right? You see, without those constraints, so I would end up holding the entire market. What should we call this portfolio that is everything in the market? Let's be imaginative and call it the market portfolio. That's what I would end up holding. That's what you will end up holding. That's what everybody in this room will end up holding. Because none of us is going to pick stocks anymore because it doesn't pay off and there are no transactions costs to stop us. Which makes it a little strange, right? We all hold the same index fund. But some of us are more risk averse than others. So let's play a game. Let's assume she is completely risk averse. She wants to take... I'm going to give you two choices. You can put your money in this index fund that has every single traded asset in the market, every traded risky asset in the market. Let's call it the market portfolio. Or you could put it in something risk-free. Those are the only two choices. Two 800 numbers, if it's the old-fashioned way. Two places online you go to invest. She is so risk averse, she wants to take no risk. What percentage of her portfolio is going to be in the risk-free asset and how much in the index fund? The 100% is going to be in the risk-free asset, nothing in the index fund. Is she doing the wrong thing? No. Given a risk aversion, she's doing exactly what she should do. She wants to take some risk. She put half her money in the index fund and half in... You want to take more, you put all your money in the index fund, nothing into the risk-free asset. Let's say he wants to take even more risk. In this world, what's the most logical way to take risk? You actually put 200% of your money... You're saying, how the hell do I do that? You borrow money and you invest in the index fund. Do you see what we're doing? We're saying diversification. I mean, you're not going to give up on diversification. You're just going to alter how much you... We all end up holding the same index fund. We're almost there in the CAPM world. We all end up holding the market portfolio. The way we think about the risk of a stock has changed completely because we all hold a market portfolio and I come to you with a stock that never existed before. I've created a new stock, Casper. You know how you measure the risk of Casper? You won't look at how risky Casper is standing alone. You look at the risk Casper adds to the market portfolio. You're saying, how am I going to measure that risk? You're going to look to see how Casper moves with the market portfolio. Statistically, it's called a covariance. Basically, Casper moves in ways that have nothing to do with the market portfolio. Adding it will do nothing to your risk. You can treat it as riskless. But if it tends to go up and the market goes up and goes down and the market goes down, it's much riskier. You measure the covariance. That's it. We're almost there. In the CAPM, the risk of a stock is not measured by its total variance. It's measured by its covariance with the market portfolio. And the CAPM would have stopped there. Bill Sharp would have stopped right there, but the covariance has a slight issue. If I told you the covariance of your stock with the market is 37%, and I said, is that a high number? What's your answer going to be? I have no idea. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take that covariance, 37%, and divide it by the variance of the market. So every covariance, I'm dividing by a constant. Let's say the variance of the market is 30%. 37 divided by 30 gives me about 1.2 something. That's a beta. A beta is just a standardized measure of covariance. But think of how much baggage I've accumulated along the way to get to the point of saying beta measures risk. I had to buy into mean variance. I had to assume the marginal investor was diversified. I had to assume no transactions costs and no private information. And if you buy into all of that, you're at the end game with the CAPM saying everybody holds a market portfolio. The risk of a stock then becomes a risk it adds to that market portfolio, and you can measure it with a beta. And let's close the loop. If you are willing to go all the way up to that point, might as well take the last step. If beta is your measure of risk, the expected return on that investment can then be written as the risk-free rate as a base. The beta measures how risky your stock is to a diversified investor, so it's scaled around one. And I'm going to multiply that beta by what an average stock will make in the market. That's what that risk premium is. Risk-free rate, beta, risk premium. I'm home free. There's only one final check I have to run, right? Does the CAPM work? And here I have some problems. Actually, I don't have problems. Lots of people have problems. I still use betas to get cost of equity. So when I value a Casper, I use betas. And when I talk about my valuation, you know what people hone in on? It's not my growth rate, not the margins, not how many mattresses I think they would sell. All big assumptions, they hone in the beta. Say, you still use betas? And the less they know, the more dangerous they become. Because beta is like Freddy Krueger. It dies every Halloween and comes back the next Halloween. It's been killed multiple times. Beta's dead, beta's dead, beta's dead. And there are a number of critiques of beta, and if you ever use betas, you've got to be ready for these critiques. The first critique is the model makes some unrealistic assumptions. Does it? Absolutely. No transactions cost, no private information, mean variance framework. To which my response is, so what? I used to be an econ major in a previous lifetime. And I still remember those realistic econ models that nobody can use. If only you knew the second differential of your utility function to wealth, everything will be clear. When will I observe it? Never. Nobody ever has. But once you see it, given a choice between an unrealistic model that makes realistic assumptions and a realistic model that makes unrealistic assumptions, I'll take the latter over the former. So if that's your only critique, it makes Hey, give me your model and we list out all the unrealistic assumptions you have to make. The second critique will come from the coward in the last row. He said, but you could have got the beta wrong. Really? That's all you think I got wrong? You should see my revenue growth rate, my margins, the number of mattresses I'm going to sell at Casper. I get everything wrong. You know why? Because I'm trying to forecast the future. If your argument against a model is sometimes it doesn't work, it's thin gruel. It really is not a critique, because that could be said about any model in economics or finance. The third critique cuts to the bone. It doesn't work that well. In fact, in 1991, two professors at the University of Chicago, Farmer and French, decided to test out whether the CAPM worked. You say, how would you test it? It's actually very simple. What does the CAPM say your only measure of risk is? Beta, right? So if the CAPM is right, and I take a very long time period of history, and I look at betas and returns in stocks, 100% of the variations in return should be explained by betas if I take a long enough time period, right? So here's what they did. They took a 30-year time period, pretty long. They looked at what percentage of the variation returns is explained by betas. And I'll give away the end game. It wasn't 100%. It wasn't 90%. It was about 7%. So basically, we're using a model that explains about 7% of variation returns. And you're saying, how do you get away with it? With an anecdote. And you can use this anytime somebody says, how come you're using a model that explains only 7% of what's going on? Because the alternatives are not that great. You're saying, what are the alternatives? I'll give you a history of risk and return models in one page here. Here's the CAPM, and I gave you the assumptions. And in the CAPM, we measured all of the risk with a single beta. 1964, the CAPM comes out. For 14 years, it's the only game in town, the CAPM or nothing. In the late 70s, Steve Ross, who was teaching at Yale at that time, said, this is silly. Why are we trying to measure all of the risk in a stock with one beta? We want to measure risk that cannot be diversified away, but risk that is affecting the market could come from interest rates, inflation, real economic growth. And he said, market risk can take different forms. Why didn't we allow for multiple sources of market risk and a beta against each one? And people said, that's a great idea, but how would we know how many sources of market risk there are and what the beta is? He said, that's very easy. Give me a powerful computer and 50 years of stock returns for individual stocks. They gave him the data. And what's the definition of market returns, market risk? It's risk that affects most or all companies at the same time, right? He sent the computer on a search mission. Called a factor analysis. He said, look through the data looking for common factors, things that seem to move the same 1,000 stocks together on multiple days. So 2 hours later, the computer comes back and says, I found 5 factors. And here are the betas against each one for each stock. This was like a gift from the heavens. Now you have a model where instead of one beta, you have 5. Or you have 5 betas, or one market factor, you have 5 market risk factors. It's called the arbitrage pricing model. And when it first came out in finance, we thought we had found the solution to our problems. But to show you why the arbitrage pricing model never acquired roots, let's play the game of somebody trying to use this model in the late 70s. So you work at Salomon Brothers, you're an investment banker, your client is Pepsi. Until last year, you estimated the hurdle rate using a beta to come up with the cost of equity. Now you show up and you say, look, we have a new model. It's called the arbitrage pricing model. We've re-estimated your hurdle rate with this new model, and it's 21%. And I say, that sounds really high. Why is it so high? And you tell me. He said, it's because you're very sensitive to the second factor. You know what my question to you is going to be, right? What the heck is the second factor? So I don't know what it is, but be very careful when it's around. When you run a factor analysis, the computer comes back and says, I found 5 factors. You know what it calls them? Factor 1, factor 2, factor 3. It's a statistical model. It doesn't know what the factors are. You try getting somebody to adopt a model where you can't tell what the factors are, you're going to have 0 chance of it succeeding. So you kick me out. Forlorn, I walk back to my office thinking about why my sales pitch didn't work. When you asked me what the second factor was, I couldn't come up with an answer, right? Therein lies a solution, which is, if I can somehow put names on the factors, then maybe I can sell you the model. So the next 6 years, people spend millions of dollars trying to attach names to factors. And you had some guidance. You knew these had to be market risk factors. There had to be things like interest rates, the term structure. 7 years and many million dollars later, people had attached names to the factors. When you attach names to the factors, you've gone from an arbitrage pricing model to what's called a multi-factor model. So now it's 1985. I show up at Pepsi again. Don't ask me what I was doing for those 6 years in the middle. I was in the wilderness. I'm back. I said, look, you know, you didn't like it when I gave it, but I now have a new model. It's called the multi-factor model. Use an acronym. It usually works, MFM. They'll have no idea what you're talking about. And say, your hurdle rate based on the multi-factor model is 19%. He said, that still sounds a little high. He said, why? And I tell you, it's because you're very sensitive to the second factor. And here, I'm ready for your next question, which is, what's the second factor? It's oil prices. I said, what? We at Pepsi don't use oil. It might taste like we do, but what's oil prices got to do with us? And herein lies the answer. How did I fit those names, the factors? I look backwards. In the 1970s, oil prices were a big factor driving stock price. I did my job. Statistically, I found the factor. The only problem, by the time you got to 85, oil prices were no longer a big factor. And this has been the bane for multi-factor models. I can attach factors. The data's there. But by the time I put a name on the factor, the factor shifts. Because each period brings a different factor into play. Multi-factor models looked like they were going to conquer the world. They never caught on. So CAPM comes out in 64 and 78. People think arbitrage pricing model, this is going to solve the problem. Passes on. Multi-factor models pass on. Then, of course, you get to this 91 paper by Farmer and French. And they find that only less than 10% is explained by the CAPM. Then they actually gave up. They said, you know, well, why are we even trying to measure risk? Why don't we let the market tell us what's risky? You're saying, how will the market tell us? They have 30 years of data in individual companies. They asked a very simple question. What kinds of companies earned high returns over these 30 years, and what kinds of companies earned low returns? And here's what they found. Small market cap companies earn much higher returns than large market cap companies. And then they made a leap of faith. They said, that must mean small market cap companies are riskier. Otherwise, why would they earn a higher return? Do you see why this is a leap of faith? You're assuming that markets are right over the long term. They found that stocks that trade at low price-to-book ratios, you know what a price-to-book ratio is, the market value relative to the book value, had higher returns than stocks that had high price-to-book ratios. They said, that must mean low price-to-book stocks are riskier than high price-to-book stocks. These are called proxy models. See why it's a proxy model? You've given up on measuring risk. You're letting something stand in for risk, saying that's what the market has been rewarding. And they actually ended up with an equation where if you told me what your market cap was and your price to book was, they said, based on history, your hurdle rate should be 11%. So guess what? If you're a small company with a low price to book ratio, you're doomed. Your hurdle rate is going to be 18%. You can show me how stable your revenues are and your earnings are. It doesn't matter. It's almost a karmic view of risk. Your risk is determined by what kind of company you are. Nothing you can do about it. And proxy models have actually caught on, but not in corporate finance, but in portfolio management to measure performance. Because what people were doing was they're playing a game. They were beating the market if you use the CAPM, because they found all the kinds of companies where the CAPM was underperforming. So if you invest in small companies, you look like you were beating the CAPM because the CAPM was not capturing the risk of those companies. But in corporate finance, if you go into consulting firms, companies, banks, you still see the CAPM dominating. And the reason it dominates, the reason it survives, is because its competition is so weak. Remember I said I'll give you an anecdote to kind of defang the opposition. If somebody says, how come you're using a model that explains less than 10% of what's going on? Tell them about these two campers who go up. It's late at night. They have a campfire going. And they're talking about big stuff. And they heard the sound of a crazed grizzly coming at them through the forest. It's killing everything in its path. They can hear other animals screaming, other campers squealing. And one of the campers gets into a sleeping bag, zips up, gets ready to die. I don't know what form that takes. And the other camper says, you know, the other camper starts jogging in place. The guy in the sleeping bag says, what are you doing? He says, I'm going to run. The guy in the sleeping bag says, don't be crazy. You can't outrun a grizzly. They're in 50, 60 miles an hour when they're crazed. The guy's jogging, he says, look, I don't have to outrun the grizzly. All I have to do is outrun you. It's a very morbid thought, but think it through. If the CAPM had to beat perfection, this is no contest. It's already lost. But if the CAPM has to beat the arbitrage pricing model, the multi-factor model, it's actually a very close race. Let me ask you a question. If you're going to estimate one beta and screw up, or five betas and screw up just as badly, why the heck would you ever estimate five betas? So until you can show me that adding complexity to the model delivers more R squared, I'm not ready to jump there, and none of the models so far. In fact, I'm going to argue that one of the reasons the CAPMS works so badly is the way people estimate inputs with the CAPM is horrendous. So we're going to talk about better ways of doing it. I think I can push it up to 20, maybe 25% R squared, never to 100%. You know why not? There are 66 million people walking around thinking Elvis is still alive. And you're trying to build a model that explains 100% of what's going on. How the heck do you do that? We've got to bring our ambitions down. We're never going to get to 100%. This might be the best you can do. And I'll give you a note of warning. There will be many managers who say, I don't like to use beta. They'll give you some reason, bad, unrealistic. And you say, what are you going to use instead? My gut. You know the R squared between gut feeling and returns is? It's definitely lower than 7%. So if you're going to tell me you don't want to use the CAPM, I'm ready to listen. But tell me what you'd use instead. It takes a model to beat a model. It's easy to beat up on the CAPM, and people do it all the time. And I'm willing to open the door, say, give me a better way of doing it. And to me, this is just a mechanism I need to get hurdle rates. If you can give me a better mechanism, I'm going to switch in a minute. Because that's really the end game here, is I need hurdle rates for companies to be able to take projects. So when you look at the CAPM surviving, the reason it survives is A, it's simple. Second, if you do it right, it's very intuitive. And third, if you estimate the parameters, I think it does at least as good and perhaps a better job than more complex models. So here's what I'd like you to start with on your company. Take your company and make that judgment about who the marginal investor in your company is. You can use Yahoo Finance, you can use Bloomberg, you can use whatever you want to kind of do the breakdown. So look at the institutional versus insider, you know, the 17 biggest investors. Make a judgment call. So don't ask me, is this right? I don't know whether it's right. It's your judgment. I'm going to trust your judgment on it. And remember, the reason it matters is whether you can use any of the risk and return models of finance. The CAPM, the arbitrage pricing model, the multi-factor model is built on how this question gets answered. So now let's start on the numbers I need to get the CAPM. So let's say you're okay with the CAPM. You know, like me, you're uncomfortable with the assumptions. You know it's unrealistic sometimes, but at least it gives you a way of coming up with hurdle rates that you might then adjust for the fact that it doesn't work that well. You need three numbers in the CAPM. The first is you need a risk-free rate. The second is you need a beta for your project investment company. And the third is you need that number in the brackets that I'm going to call an equity risk premium, the premium you demand for investing in average risk stocks. Risk-free rate, equity risk premium, beta. Of the three, the one that should be simplest should be the risk-free rate. Let's get that out of the way. To show you how little time we used to spend on the risk-free rate, in my MBA program that was eons ago, 2 years, and I don't know, it was much cheaper then. No. You know how much time you spent on the risk-free rate? I think a minute and a half. We were told to use the U.S. Treasury rate as a risk-free rate, and then we moved on. Shows you how dollar-centric my MBA program was and how much trust there was that if you had a treasury, it was automatically risk-free. So I'm going to lay the foundations for thinking about risk-free rates by first giving you the definition of what I think of as risk-free. On a risk-free investment, you need to know exactly what you will make with certainty. There can be no uncertainty about the number, yeah. Which means that for something to be risk-free, two conditions have to be met. The first is the entity issuing the security can have no default risk, none, not even a little iota. And the second is there can be no reinvestment risk. You're saying, what are you talking about? Let's say you have a 10-year time horizon, and you're working in dollars, and you want a risk-free rate for 10 years. Is a three-month T-bill, so let's assume the Treasury has no default risk, is a three-month T-bill risk-free if you're looking at a 10-year time horizon? Why not? Because at the end of 3 months, what do you have to do? Invest in another 3 months at a rate you don't know today. So three-month T-bill is so what would be closer to risk-free? How about a 10-year T-bond, right? But even a 10-year T-bond has a little glitch in it. Every 6 months, what do you get on that bond? You get coupons that you have to reinvest. Remember, you don't need the cash till the end of the 10th year. At what rate, you don't know. So to get rid of that risk, you need to get rid of the coupons. Actually, think of this almost like a shopping coupon list. There's a principal, there are 20 coupons you're going to get. Can I strip the coupons from a treasury bond? Yeah, for 30 years we've been able to do it. And when you strip that, you end up with what's called a zero coupon T-bond. And basically, in a zero coupon 10-year bond, all you receive is the principal at the end of the 10th year. And if you're a purist and you ask me what's the risk-free rate for a 10-year cash flow, my answer is find a 10-year zero coupon bond. That'll be a rate. I've opened a Pandora's box here. And here's why. When you do capital budgeting, you're going to have cash flows in year one, cash flows in year two, cash flows in year three, cash flows in year four. And if you're a purist, what should you be doing? Taking the 1 year zero. It's actually not difficult. You can go to Bloomberg, look up the zero yield curve and take the 1 year. But it's going to mean you can't use the present value function in Excel anymore because your discount rate is actually going to be different for each year. There's a reason I'm not a purist. Because this is a pain in the neck. I have enough stuff to worry about in estimation. The last thing I want to do is to do your specific risk-free rates, even though that's the right thing. So I'm going to steal a concept that banks used to use when they actually did banking. You know, the old-fashioned banking, you made loans. And then in a bank, you have interest rate risk, right? So your assets are... The way you deal with that risk is by matching your assets to your liabilities. So if you have a one-year liability, make sure you have a one-year asset. The problem is you have hundreds of liabilities, and matching each one precisely is going to take an incredible amount of work and effort. So you know what banks used to do? They used to take the average duration of their assets and try to set it equal to the average duration. It's not perfect, but it gets you close enough. Do you see where I'm going to go? You have a capital budgeting project of cash flows for the next 10 years. It's true, you have cash flows in year one, two. I'm going to compute, if you think about a 10-year project, your duration on those cash flows might be 7 or 8 years, closer to the 10 because your big cash flows tend to come later. So let's say a 10-year project has an 8-year duration. I'm going to find a T-bond with roughly the same duration, and I'm going to use that as my risk-free rate for all 10 cash flows. Not perfect, but it's going to be close enough that I can get away with it. In fact, I'll make your life even simpler. In corporate finance, you're never, ever going to be dealing with 3-month cash flows, 6-month cash flows. You shouldn't be. You're almost always looking at long-term cash flows. Just find a 10-year risk-free rate and just use it as your risk-free rate in everything you do. So all I need to do is find a 10-year rate from an entity that has no default risk. Right? That's basically all I need. I'll start with the easy currencies first. If you give me a currency like the US dollar, I might say, look, take the 10-year T-bond. I'm not even going to find a zero coupon 10-year bond. Just find a 10-year bond rate. Roughly speaking, that's about an 8-year duration. That risk-free rate today would be about 1.7%. That is going to become my risk-free rate in US dollars. And then right after I do that, I'm going to get down on my knees and say, please, God, let there be no default risk in the US Treasury. Because remember, that's, you know, there's no guarantee that the US Treasury will never default. But I'm implicitly assuming no default risk. So when I view the government as default free, and that's a view, then I can take the government bond rate, the 10-year government bond rate, and use that as my risk-free rate. So for the US dollar, I'm going to use the T-bond rate. Some of you are doing how many of you are doing European companies? Actually, let me be more specific. How many of you are doing companies in the Eurozone? Okay, who are you doing? So Inditex, basically, you need a euro risk-free rate, right? So all I need to do is find a 10-year government bond rate denominated in euros. And this numbers, all these numbers have to be updated. But the problem I have is I have too many bonds, right? I have Germany, Austria, France. Basically, you can go around. Now, you can say, I'm doing a Spanish company. Inditex is a Spanish company. I'm going to use the Spanish bond rate. But what's the problem? These are all euro bonds. The only reason they're different is why? Because the market perceives default risk in some countries. And no. So if I use the Spanish government bond rate, I should never call it risk-free because it can't be risk-free. In fact, if you're ever caught up in this notion of it's a government bond, it must be risk-free, I have three words I'd like you to repeat every night for the next 10 nights. The three words are Greek government bond, Greek government bond. You will never use the two as interchangeable. Of course there's risk in government bonds. So what should I use as my risk-free rate in November of 2013? I'm going to use the German rate. You know why? Not because I like Germany. I do like Germany. That's not the reason. It's because it's the lowest of the rates. In fact, you could even argue that the German euro bond has some default risk, because remember, the minute you adopted the euro, one of the things you lost power over was the printing presses, that maybe I should use an ECB rate. But guess what? The German rate is actually lower than the ECB, which tells you a little bit about the ECB and the euro. So I'm going to use the German. But don't get too caught up in the German part of it. If 10 years from now, the Portuguese 10-year bond rate was the lowest, miracles can happen, I'd be using the Portuguese rate. So if you're doing an analysis in euros, your risk-free rate should be, and right now you're going to run into a little bit of a problem, and we'll come back and talk about it. Right now, you know what the German 10-year euro bond rate is? It's minus 0.5%. Let that kind of, how many econ classes did you take where interest rates were negative? I never took one. It boggles the mind. But before you do anything rash, we'll come back and talk about why risk-free rates can turn negative and why you shouldn't do anything about it. Just leave it as is. But if you're doing analysis in euros, you're going to use the German euro bond rate. So let me show you what the rates look like in November of 2013, where I could find a default-free entity. You know my definition for default-free was? I delegated this to Moody's and said, tell me what's default-free. So guess what all these countries, what all of these bonds share in common? The governments were AAA rated, and I said, if Moody's tells me they're, this is a very dangerous place I am, but think of the alternative, which is I have to do research on government default risk, and I don't want to go there. So these are all AAA rated entities where I was able to find a government bond with a 10-year rate, so I have risk-free rates. Now we'll come back and talk about why risk-free rates vary across currencies, but let's talk about the difficult currencies. These are easy currencies because all I have to do is find a AAA. Finding the German euro bond rate, all I have to do is open up the Financial Times, it's right there. Finding the Swiss franc rate, not a big deal. US dollar, not a big deal at all. But what if you have to get a risk-free rate in Chinese renminbi or Indian rupees or Brazilian reais? Now we're looking at a much tougher climb. And here's why. You can start with the government bond rate, but you can't stop there. Do you see why? Because if I take the Indian government bond rate in rupees and I come up with a number, it might not be risk-free. Whenever I say this in India, the pushback I get is, of course it's risk-free. What's the argument that people use for why local currency bonds issued by governments are default-free? What should governments be able to do if they have to ever pay off the debt? Run the printing presses faster. Technically, that's true, right? You're saying, why would any government default on its own currency bonds? The answer is because they do. You know, half of all sovereign defaults in the last 30 years have been local currency defaults. In fact, to give the most egregious example, in the late 90s, the Russian government defaulted on its ruble bonds and paid off its foreign currency. It tells you a little bit about how the Russian government views its own bondholders, especially if they're all in Russia. But governments do default on the local currency bonds, which means that I have a government bond rate in rupees. I'm not done. That is a government bond rate. It's not risk-free. To get it risk-free, what do I need to do? I need to take out of it how much of that rate is due to default risk. You think that's going to be a nightmare? I'll give you three ways of doing it because I think we have to do it. So in this case, let's take in November of 2013, the Indian government bond rate was 8.82%. Now remember, the Indian government bond in rupees is not the T-bond. It's not a deep, wide market. So you've got to take the liquidity as a given. Some government bond rates, you're going to say, really? So when the Venezuelan government reports that its government bond rate is 15%, you say, I don't think so. Because when your inflation rate is 500,000%, the only way people buy your bonds at 15%, you hold a gun to their hand and say, buy the bond now. Yeah. But let's take the 8.82% as a traded rate. I want to figure out how much of that 8.82% is due to default risk. Here's what I did. I looked up the rating for India on Moody's, and this is a local currency rating. Moody's actually reports two ratings for every country, a foreign currency rating and a local currency rating. If that local currency rating for India had been AAA, I'd have just left the 8.82% as my risk-free rate. It was Baa2. Not awful, but not AAA. The default spread that I estimated for a Baa2 rated sovereign bond in 2013, and I'll talk about how I do this at the start of every year, was about 2.25%. Let's set up an algebra problem. The Indian government bond rate is 8.82%. I'm worried that some of it is due to default risk. And if you accept my assessment of what that default risk is, 2.25% of that is due to default risk. So if I wanted a risk-free rate in rupees, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the 8.82% and take out the default risk because I want to get to something risk-free. I want everybody to get the intuition first before I talk about where I get the two. Because if I use the 8.82%, it's not risk-free. I'm bringing into something that I call a risk-free rate some risk, and I don't want that to be the case. I follow the same process for the Chinese renminbi. Again, I take the government bond rate. The rating for China is much higher than for India, AA3. The default spread is lower. I get a risk-free rate. So you give me currencies where there is default risk. I start with the government bond rate, but I clean up by subtracting out the default spread. You're saying, where do I get default spreads? Because to do this, you need default spreads. And that's really what I'll do next. But in some countries, you'll give up. You'll give up even trying to do this because it's impossible to do, either because there's no government bond, Egyptian pounds. You can look as much as you want, but there are no 10-year Egyptian bond rates. Or because the inflation in that currency is so high, you just won't want to deal with that currency. And you have two choices. One is you can do your analysis entirely in a different currency. US dollars, euros, where you can get a risk-free rate. Or you can do everything in real terms. Take currency entirely out of the equation. In real terms, you're ignoring inflation in your numerator and your denominator. And you know what? For 20 years in Latin America, probably through 2010, almost everything you saw in any Latin American country was either done in dollars or in real terms. Nobody wanted to deal with things in nominal reals, nominal pesos, because they just threw up their hands. There are too many zeros showing up here. So when you're looking at a company in a different country, I would like you to try to get a risk-free rate in local currency, but if it gets really hopeless, switch currencies. And in fact, when you do that, you're going to end up with the same answer, and I'm going to talk about why. But you first have to go through the process to make that judgment. So a little bit about these default spreads. You're saying, where did that 2.25 and 0.8% come from? I'll give you three ways of getting the default spread. The first is if your country has dollar or euro-denominated bonds, you can use those bonds to back out a default spread for the country. As an example, in November of 2013, the Brazilian government had dollar-denominated 10-year bonds that had a rate of 4.25% on them. The T-bond rate on that day was 2.75%. Do you see what I'm going to do? They're both dollar bonds, so I should be able to compare them. If I take the difference, I get a default spread based on the government bond of 1.5%. This will work only if your country has dollar or euro-denominated bonds. There are about 15 countries where this is true. Much of Latin America has dollar-denominated bonds. Parts of Eastern Europe, like Poland, has a euro-denominated bond. You can compare to the German euro bond rate. So that's the first approach. The second, and this is a more recent entrant into the information game, is for the last 20 years or so, you've got what are called sovereign credit default spreads. You're saying, what the heck is that? It's a way in which you can insure yourself against default risk by going to that market. And the nice thing about that market is that the number you're getting is actually a default spread. So the number for Brazil, for instance, in November of 2013 was 2.5%. So if you bought a Brazilian bond and you're worried about default risk, you go to the CDS market and buy a CDS, and every year from your coupon, you'd have to pay out 2.5%. The nice thing about a sovereign CDS spread is it reflects what's happening right now. Government bonds might not be traded, but if something terrible happens in a country, you're going to see the CDS spread almost instantaneously react to it. You're going to see it play out. So it's a market-based number. And the third, the sovereign CDS is now available for about 70 countries. I'll send you the whole list after class so you can see what they look like at the start of 2020. And then you have a third approach, which is for countries where you can get neither a government bond in dollars or a CDS. And there are about 90 or 95 countries where you can get a rating. And I have a lookup table I've created based on countries where I can look up a spread, where if you tell me what your sovereign rating is a country, I'll tell you what spread should go with that rating. So I update these numbers. So if you tell me right now, it's Baa2, as looking across Baa2 sovereigns, your spread should be roughly 2%. You think, what if I have all three? Pick one, just move on. Many countries, you might have two out of three. Some countries, you're going to get one and be happy. Then say, look, I don't have to make a choice. Some countries, you might have none. And that's when you switch currencies, right? So I'm going to leave you with a final picture, and I'm going to plant a question. And if you can answer this question, I'm going to argue you've cracked what I call the currency code. These were the risk-free rates in all of the currencies for which I was able to estimate a risk-free rate in 2013. I update this, and I'll give you the updated numbers, you know, for 2020, what they look like. But basically, you're saying, what are these bars? The total bar is the government bond rate. The purple is the default spread. So basically, I'm taking out the default spread. What's left, the gray part, is my risk-free rate in currencies ranging from the Taiwanese dollar to the Brazilian real. Okay. Risk-free rates vary across currencies. That's clear from the graph. And you probably had that prior already. So here's my question. I want you to think about this before your Monday class. Why do risk-free rates